Hannah Murray on TRE in the afternoon.
Joining us on the line now is David Tereshkook. He's a journalist who has spent time working in broadcast media in the UK, the US and Ireland, interviewing world leaders such as Robert Mugabe, Nelson Mandela and Tony Blair. In his latest book, A Question of Paternity, he attempts to uncover the truth of his father's identity. Welcome to the show, David.
Well, hello. Thank you for having me on the show, Hannah. That's great of you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's lovely to have you with us. And before we talk about your book and this amazing story, I have to ask you about your broadcasting career, interviewing all those people. What was it like sitting face to face with Robert Mugabe?
Robert Mugabe was a man who was difficult to deal with. I think that's putting it at its simplest. I rather admired the man to begin with. A long time ago, when I first came across him, I didn't meet him personally then. He was in prison when he first came to my attention. I knew his wife, and he was a doughty fighter for independence, for what we now know as Zimbabwe. At the time, it was called Southern Rhodesia, and it was a British colony, but ruled over by colonists, local white colonists, who were in rebellion against the British Crown at the time. But he was thrown in prison, and as I say, I got to know the family, and only later, when that liberation war was over and he was released from prison, and then he became, first of all, prime minister and then president, almost for life. He died eventually, but he was put out of office by his own cabinet members and his own army in the end. He was one of those leaders who changed once he got into power. He was an inspiring leader for a long time, but then when he finally got to the top position, he wanted, surprise surprise, to keep that position, and turned himself into the kind of demagogue that we're all too familiar with, I'm afraid, across the world. Refused to give up the reins of power, and I found him a truculent individual, hard to talk to, and was extraordinarily dismissive of what I thought were perfectly reasonable questions that I was asking him.
And Nelson Mandela, you interviewed the day before he was elected the first black president of post-apartheid South Africa.
Yes, it's not one of my most substantial interviews, I have to say, to be perfectly honest. I managed to grab maybe 5, maybe 6 minutes of his time. He was being hustled along to be interviewed in a formal way by the three major American commercial networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC, on the very eve, as you say, of being elected president of the first black majority democratic country of South Africa after 300 years of white supremacist rule. And it was felt very important by his party managers that he talked to the major networks from New York. I was there in a different capacity. I was working for the United Nations at the time, in fact, recording this very important moment of history in which the United Nations played a part. They helped the new country, much changed country, of course, organize its elections. I mean, they'd never had an election that involved the entire population. Previously, only the white population were able to vote. So he was on his way to these formal set-piece interviews, and we were in a big hotel, which happened to be the headquarters of the African National Congress, the party he led. And I basically just ambushed him with my TV crew. The term of art we use in our profession was doorstep, but ambush is a more honest version of what happened. And his bodyguards wanted to stop me doing it, but he very quietly, in fact, wordlessly, just with a wave of his hand, he made it clear that he was prepared to stop and exchange a few words with me, and he did. And it was it was one of the most extraordinary experiences of my life. I'd covered the Southern Africa liberation movements for something at that point like 30 years, maybe. And he, of course, was a giant in that world. And I can't say that my questions were especially probing. In fact, I rather lost my train of thought. I couldn't help thinking to myself, at a high sort of high decibel level in my head, I'm here with Nelson Mandela.
Yes.
In the kitchen, because that's where we were. We were in a corridor full of kitchen produce, sacks of flour, and enormous industrial-sized cans of tomato. So it was a weird situation, but he was gracious enough to you know.
Give you some time.
Give me a little of his time.
Yeah. Yes, lovely. So, you know, in your career, you're used to doing these amazing interviews and, you know, asking difficult questions and sometimes getting some difficult answers. But the point of this book is that you struggled to get quite a simple, some might say, answer out of your mother for many years as to who your father was.
That's right. Yeah, it was a strange sort of paradox to my life. I did go around the world asking questions and getting answers. And here in my personal private life, I couldn't get an answer to that simple, sort of simple. Turned out to be a lot more complicated than I thought when I started pressing the question. But I didn't press the question until quite a late point in my life. I mean, as a child, our family was a very quiet, secretive kind of context in which to grow up. I think I was warned away from the topic, and I wasn't to discuss it. My mother had been 15 when I was conceived. She was 16 when I was born. It was clearly a matter of great scandal in the small village on the border between England and Scotland. Rural conditions, we were poor, we were living in public housing. And I think this was a matter of shame to our family, the secret was kept. And I don't remember ever being told out loud that I should not not bring up the topic, but I didn't bring it up, never did. And as I grew up, I began to tell myself that it didn't matter. It wasn't all that important. It didn't interest me. I was much more interested in my career. And in the end, it took until I was in my 40s before I was able to tackle my mother fully. And then she promised me an answer. And then she was still a little evasive and then finally gave me an answer that was rather shocking. Not rather shocking, it was very shocking.
Yeah.
And then started my quest to find out more about it.
And she sent you this shocking information in a fax, which must have been difficult to read.
That rather dates me, Hannah, doesn't it? yes, this is in 2001. And yes, my mother chose to use a fax to send me the information that she'd been raped at the age of 15 by a Roman Catholic priest. Of course, the French have a word for that, bouleversé. I was toppled over completely. And I gathered my senses, I suppose, eventually, and had a lot more of a conversation with her than the simple facts, of course. I had a long talk with her then about how it all happened, according to her. And that was the story I dealt with until it became clear that there were some anomalies in this story. As I started to apply my, you know, the sort of approach that I would as an investigative journalist, which I've been for part of my career, and looking back and doing a lot of historical archive research too, these anomalies started to occur, and I realized that there was a much bigger, or a much more varied and a different kind of story afoot here, perhaps. And that's why the search continued from then until now. And it doesn't take anything away from what the book has to tell you, but I can say that the search still continues.
Yeah. And even though it seemed like late in your 40s to find out this information and for you and your mother to talk about it for the first time, looking back, does it sort of feel like maybe it was the right time that it happened? I mean, such a difficult conversation, such a difficult subject wouldn't have been easy to do when you were 14, for example, would it?
Oh, yes, I see what you mean. And I'd probably agree if I thought about it. But the absolute truth about it was that I told myself I didn't care. I never did bring it up at 14. I had bigger fish to fry, I thought. At the time, I was a rebellious teenager and making my own way. And I got to university kind of early because I wanted to break away from the family. And at university, I discovered the joys of journalism and and then sank myself into that. That became my main life's project. The idea of finding out who my father was a long way from my thoughts.
Yeah. So after having this conversation with your mother, you were determined to find the priest's identity and find the priest himself. How did you go about doing that then?
Well, I got a lot of help. One obvious point that I knew, I mean, one curiosity perhaps is that my journalism, for a large slice of my career, was concerned with religion. I was in charge of a division of making programs about religion and ethics for the ITV network in Britain. I was still living in Britain then. I now live in New York. But at that point, and then again, when I was in America, I covered that same territory. So I had lots of contacts in the world of religion. What was very clear to me is that this matter of sexual abuse against a minor, a 15-year-old girl, by a member of a clerical order, was something of a highly sensitive nature. And doing what my colleagues in my business would call front door inquiries was likely not to get too far. At that point in time, the church was, the Catholic Church worldwide, really, it was happening in all in many countries in the Western world and the developing world. A certain amount of denial was still very solidly in place at the Catholic Church. And there was even many instances of cases of clerical sexual abuse being covered up by the authorities, the church authorities. So I didn't expect to get easy answers by what we would call front door inquiries. And I got a lot of insider help doing my research in a side of kind of almost undercover way. People in the church helped me. People in law enforcement in Britain helped me. We did some interesting detective work, I suppose you could call it. And we found a man, a priest, who looked as if he might fit the bill. We traced his course up until his death. But then the modern miracle of DNA science intervened, and we were able to discover through this new scientific approach, I mean, new to us, myself and my small team that were devoted to this, including a genetic genealogist, we discovered that relatives of this particular priest had put their DNA online, and guess what? There was not a shred of connection to me. So that was a dead end, and I'm afraid I encountered quite a few dead ends as I continued my search. One of the points I think that almost a recurring feature of this book is that I kept hitting obstacles and dead ends that disappointed me at pretty well every turn that I took in the search.
You did discover that you had German relatives, though. How did that happen?
Yes, that came later as my DNA entered the databases of these many genealogy websites that I'm sure you're familiar with, like Ancestry.com and MyHeritage.com and 23andMe. My DNA was being compared with other people's DNA in about a dozen of these databases. So they were trawling through something like 7 million people, I believe, at one point. And yes, you're right. Matches kept popping up, not very close matches, but interestingly enough matches to suggest, enough of a close match to suggest that I might be the second or third cousin with these individuals in Germany who are popping up. And so that put a whole new dimension or direction, I should perhaps say, on my search. More and more, we ended up trying to find people who might have had a relative, more and more people in Germany who might have had a relative who was in Britain at the relevant time. I was born in 1948, and it's conceivable. This evidence was beginning to suggest that it might have been a prisoner of war, because there was a prisoner of war camp near my village, and people who had been captured were kept until well after the end of World War II, indeed right up until 1948, the year that I was born.
Gosh, and I have to ask you, the fact that the DNA didn't match with this priest that you had found, were you still able to discuss that with your mother? I mean, what does that tell you about
it wasn't open for discussion. My mother, I believe, it's hard to know. I mean, unfortunately, my mother died during the course of all this. But even when she was still alive, she felt she'd dealt with the matter as fully as she ever would, and wouldn't discuss it anymore. And anyway, the fact that I found somebody with DNA that did not match me wasn't anything that I think would make any dent on her sense that she'd told me the story and she'd given me an answer as I wanted one, and that was the end of it.
Yeah, and one other thing I just want to ask you, the fact that we don't want to stop people from reading the book because people want to find out what happened and also learn more about your journey, but you said at the beginning that you're still searching, that the search continues. Have you, throughout this process, been able to find, because you're still searching, have you still been able to find some kind of peace or closure on the subject?
I'm in a state of not knowing the full truth. That's something that is, I suppose, I have to admit, is disappointing. That's true. And also, my professional training, my whole outlook, really, throughout my working life has been wanting to get to the facts, the absolutely ascertainable facts, and be totally sure of things. So, you know, almost in a profound inward way, this is disappointing. But on the other hand, I have learned a lot. I've learned a lot more than I had. You know, I have a lot more information now than I had before. And I've learned a lot about my mother, too. And I think several things have happened for me. I've ended up accepting that perhaps there are some secrets that are not soluble. This one may not be solved. It's just possible that some very close connection to me in terms of DNA will pop up, probably in Germany, and the mystery will be solved. But I think I'm prepared to accept that it may not. And at the same time, I've learned such a lot more about my mother and her life that I may have been angry at her for not, you know, for keeping the secret from me all that time, and then perhaps feeding me a red herring when she did give me information. But I've also come to see that my only appropriate response to her now, as I consider the whole circumstances of her life and why she might have wanted to keep that secret, I can only feel compassion.
Lovely. Well, that's beautiful. And it's been really lovely to chat with you, David Tereshkik. Thank you so much for joining us. And if listeners want to get a copy of the book, it's called A Question of Paternity, and it's available on our website. David, thank you so much.
Thank you, Hannah. Thank you.